Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Today we have an amazing guest, Stephanie Munaz. Many of you know Stephanie as a professional yoga researcher. And I think what you'll find during our discussion today is there is so much more to Stephanie than maybe meets the eye. I think sometimes when we meet someone who's achieved a lot or accomplished big professional things, we kind of forget that there's like a real human underneath it all that has had challenging life experiences and has had to work through the things that all of us have to work through, maybe even more. And so I love this interview. It is a little bit heavy to really hold space for and hear all of the things that Stephanie has gone through in the last 7 years personally, which also impacted her professionally, of course. You know, the memoir that she wrote called Driving Home is looking at this experience of her life, this beautiful tragedy, as she says, that even in the midst of so much challenge, there's also beautiful things happening simultaneously. And so as you listen, I hope that you are well resourced, that you're in a space where you can kind of be with both the light and the dark all at the same time. You know, hopefully you're in a place where if you heard a swear word, it would be okay. You know, if you're already struggling today, maybe you'll set this one aside for another day. It is beautiful. It is a wonderful story that she's telling. And I found myself getting choked up a few times because there's a lot of depth of suffering that has happened in Stephanie's body, mind, and spirit. And even throughout all of it, there's also this witness or this observer that could watch what was happening, but also still be steady and still be the eternal part of Stephanie. So let's go meet Stephanie, and thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of these stories, these journeys. I think they're really important for all of us to hear from one another so that we don't just see someone as a small sliver of who they are, that we see each other in our wholeness. So we'll start off with Stephanie talking about her professional life, and then we'll move to the other side and go into a deep, deep personal story. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. I'm Amy Wheeler, your host. Are you needing to earn some continuing education units? Well, we have the exact thing for you. Every single Monday night, we have a Monday night clinic where we practice postures, breathing, and meditation towards a very specific theme of the month. And then we stay afterwards and we talk about the theory of why we chose what we did for that particular practice. We give you a completion certificate, which you can turn into your continuing education body. And we're growing all the time. We have a wonderful community. You can do this live with us online, or you can do it through a recording. Go to www.theoptimalstate.com and check out the Monday Night Clinic, and we would love to see you there. Welcome, Stephanie. Thank you for being here today.
I'm really excited to talk with you, Amy. I always enjoy these chats, and I love what you're doing with this podcast, so I'm happy to be a part of it.
Thank you. It's really popular. I was only going to do it for a year, but we're already filled up through the end of December, and more people are asking if they can tell their stories. I might continue it. I really love hearing all of these stories that people have. So
awesome.
So Stephanie, just to give people a little background about who you are and what you do in the world, I think you're a really important person to our community and to our field. And I think sometimes as a yoga researcher, maybe you're not out in front in every, you know, article, every Facebook post. You're quietly doing really important things for all of us, but maybe a little behind the scenes. And I know you have yoga for arthritis and you're out in front for that whole program, which we'll talk about later. But tell us a little bit about your day job, because I want everyone to know who you are, and especially about the clarity guidelines. Not too long, but just to kind of give a framework for who is Stephanie.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amy. So I am a yoga researcher, which I think is like the coolest job title on the planet. Sometimes when I tell people what I do, they look at me, you know, wondering, is that actually a job? I am the research director at SCU, Southern California University of Health Sciences, which has programs in all kinds of integrative health and applied health. But I am the director of research for the whole university. And as I was at MUIH, Maryland University of Integrative Health, and in that role, I support a culture of research and research activity among the faculty more broadly and student opportunities for research. But also, I am working on my own body of research, which has for over 20 years now been the study of the application of yoga to populations with arthritis and chronic pain conditions. So with a variety of different research methodologies, I'm a mixed methods researcher, which means I do quantitative and qualitative studies. And it includes in-depth interviews and focus groups and surveys, but also clinical trials, randomized controlled trials, pilot studies, summary research, systematic reviews, all around this broader question of how the tools of yoga impact the lives of people who are living with arthritis and chronic pain conditions. And you mentioned yoga for arthritis. Honestly, I started yoga for arthritis when I was first starting to do this research during my PhD in public health. I was concerned that the research I was doing would stay behind the scenes, like you were saying. And a lot of research gets read by other researchers. And I was finding such powerful transformation in this really emerging area of research. There was very little published on this topic when I started. And yoga for arthritis was the vehicle for taking this work out of the ivory tower and actually bringing it to people living with arthritis and chronic pain, and also to yoga professionals so that they could work with this population.
Well done. Well done. And, you know, people think that we have all this great research. And, you know, if you look on PubMed or some of these places, like, yeah, there's a lot of yoga studies out there, but are they high quality yoga studies? Do we even know what they did as an intervention? Like, how many times a week? For how long? Is there a certain style they used? Were there particular postures that they leaned into, like back bends or restorative? So another whole part of what you've done that I appreciate for the field is this thing called the Clarity Guidelines. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, thank you, because I forgot to go down that road, Amy. So CLARIFY, we love acronyms in research. And so CLARIFY is the acronym for what's called an extension reporting guideline. So when we are developing a research manuscript and publishing it, there are these guidelines that we use for what has to be included, usually about the methodology. How were people randomized? What were the inclusion and exclusion criteria? What were the outcomes? How were they measured? And so there are really clear, well-developed, long-standing guidelines for different types of research, for randomized controlled trials, for observational studies, for case reports. And those are about the study methodology broadly, no matter what kind of intervention it is. There is specific information that we need about certain kinds of interventions that's not going to be in that guideline. And this doesn't only exist for yoga. There are lots of fields that need specific information. Like if you're publishing an acupuncture study, you need to know what points were used, what gauge of needle, how long were they in, right? Those kinds of things are important for it to be replicated, to do it again, but also for it to be applied clinically. If we say, okay, acupuncture is good for low back pain, but what was the acupuncture? How do you actually use that? And so for yoga therapists to be able to apply the research, which we call evidence-informed practice, how do you do it if you don't know what happened in the research study? So the CLARIFY guideline was developed to provide guidance about what needs to be included in a yoga manuscript, because there was a lot of yoga research early on, you know, 20 years ago that said we offered yoga once a week. Well, what yoga? How long? You know, all of those things that you're talking about. And if one study showed an effect and another didn't, and they did wildly different practices, that's important information. So the Clarify guideline, actually, many of your listeners may have been a part of it, because the way that we developed it, which is common for developing a guideline like this, is through expert consensus. And who are the experts in a yoga intervention? People who have been involved in a yoga intervention, which is not just the research scientists, but also the people who designed, delivered, you know, served as subject matter experts on these yoga trials. So we queried anybody who had been involved in a yoga study of any kind, observational case report, et cetera, in a certain time period. And we asked them, all right, out of these things, what do you think the importance is? Rate it for us of including this or this. And by the way, what did we miss? What did we not think of that should be added? And this happens in a few different rounds, building toward a consensus. And as with any kind of consensus, it's imperfect. But where we landed with the Clarify guidelines is a starting place for, honestly, it is the minimum of what should be included in a research manuscript. And now this is being used by authors who are writing the manuscript, but it's also being used by editors of journals, by the peer reviewers who are looking at these manuscripts, even by the research team when they're initially designing their study, to think about what kinds of things do we need to consider as we're developing a yoga intervention. And so what we hope to see is that over time, this creates a shift in the field toward more transparent and more useful yoga research. And the guideline can change. So as we've seen with other guidelines, it can get an update. If we start using it and we realize, actually, this is a little more important, this doesn't need to be in there so much, there can be future additions. But this is a starting place for improving the clarity and usefulness of yoga research going forward.
Love it. And, you know, I started a study probably 4 years ago without knowing about it. And now I'm having to write it up. You know, it's easier to implement something like this when you know up front that this is the format that I need to be using. So I'm just really appreciative that you took the time to do that for our field. And I think, you know, it's planting seeds for generations to come.
Thank you, Amy. I love to see when people who had nothing to do with the development of it mention it. Like sometimes if I'm doing a peer review, I'll see the comments from the other reviewer. And it'll say, you know, you really should be using the Clarify guideline to report this more strongly. So it is getting used.
Yeah, I just reviewed a study the other day and I wrote that in there.
Excellent.
This would be helpful. And I think, you know, we're so new that it's educating each other even. Not everyone's heard of it yet.
Yeah, spread the word. Thank you.
All right. So that's your professional life. And, you know, in yoga, we could say that's the clothing you're wearing, your identity out there in the world. But then there's also Stephanie, this person inside that has gone through so many things in life, even though she's a high power woman in the field of yoga and academia. There's a Stephanie that is also vulnerable and tender and has all sorts of really hard things happening in life, just like everyone, right? So can we switch to that, Stephanie?
Yeah, it's funny, Amy. So I'm sure we'll talk about the memoir that I wrote about this, but my first book was on yoga therapy for arthritis, very professional. And it felt really challenging to do because I was trying to get my whole professional life's work into this book. And the stakes of that felt really high. That was nothing compared to like opening up your heart and putting your life story on the page as I did with this memoir. So yeah, let's go there.
And especially since, you know, someone might see you at a sitar conference or a SYR conference and be like, oh my gosh, there's Stephanie. You know, like she's amazing. And like, I think all of us look at very highly skilled professional people and we forget like there's a real human in there that has nothing to do with all the accomplishments that they've had in this life.
Or maybe does.
Or maybe it does. Yeah, there's absolutely a connection. But I just think whenever I see a very powerful person, like, I don't think of all the trials and tribulations they've been through. I think of all the wonderful things they've done, you know? So tell us about this, Stephanie, that's been here all along, but you had a really hard period at one point a few years ago. I don't even know where to start the story.
I'll
Tell
start
me.
the story and
Okay, you
then we
start
can
it.
take it from there.
Okay.
So I will preface this by saying I have had an incredibly blessed life and a relatively easy one, honestly. Throughout my life, doors have opened and I have had the wherewithal to take the opportunity and walk through them. And, you know, that's a whole other conversation about serendipity and how we create it and notice it. But this particular year that I write about in the book was the hardest thing I have ever been through on a deep personal level. I've had a lot of challenges, like you talked about, in accomplishing things, right? It takes a lot of grit to be able to do the things that I've done out in the world. But this year that I wrote about personally rocked me, like down to the bare bones, down to the essential nature of who I am. So I'll tell you, you know, the basic outer story of what happened, and then we can sort of get into the layers of it. The circumstance was that I had done my doctoral work at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore and met my husband there and started a family. So we were in Baltimore, but I am from the outskirts of Philadelphia. That's where my family immigrated to. That's where all my aunts, uncles, and cousins are. That's my hometown. And so I was 3 hours away, and we would visit for holidays, more than, you know, just the holidays. We would get up there pretty often, but it was a 3-4 hour drive with young kids, maybe even more than that. And my mother got cancer. And my mother was very healthy, did not have a thing wrong with her health up until this point. And so it took us all by surprise. The diagnosis that she had carried with it a prognosis of an 18-month average. So she was expected to live for 18 months. We promised to move home. We had actually promised to move back before that, but sort of way leads onto way, and it's easy to get caught up in your life, and it's hard to relocate your family and your jobs, et cetera. And the longer it went on, so my mother outlived the 18 years by a lot, but the longer she lived, the more I feared she didn't have a whole lot more time left.
And you just said years. So was it years or months?
So she was given 18 months. She
Okay.
ended up living 6 years.
Oh, wow.
So a lot longer than expected. But it was 5 years in, or, you know, close to that, when I said to my husband, I don't know how much time she has left, and I will never forgive myself. Now, whether that's true, whether I could actually forgive myself is another story, but I felt a strong need, a drive to make good on this promise and move home. My mother wanted the family life that we all had growing up, which was everybody over for dinner once a week and being at the kids' activities and, you know, that kind of intergenerational family life. So I ended up moving with my daughter in with my parents, left my husband and son behind because my husband could not easily move his job. And my son was in full day kindergarten, which you couldn't get outside of Philly. So they stayed behind and we were driving back and forth every week to see each other. So I was up in Pennsylvania with my parents and my daughter. Husband and son were down in Baltimore every weekend driving back and forth, which was a lot, you know, putting my daughter in new schools, all of that, living with my parents, which was an adjustment. And then I got hit by a truck, semi truck. I was actually on my way to the Integral Yoga Institute in New York, which I wouldn't normally drive to, but had to for various reasons. And I ended up getting hit by the semi truck and suffered a traumatic brain injury. So now my family is divided. My mother has cancer. I have a brain injury. And then my mother's cancer, which was stage 4 from the beginning, further metastasized to her brain and her liver. So now my mother is rapidly deteriorating. I am feeling all of the many multi-kosha effects of a traumatic brain injury. And my husband and son are in another state. And so navigating all of that as a daughter of a dying mom, as a parent to a displaced child, as myself, a patient, and also a clinician and a scientist who can't use her brain in the same way she's accustomed to, and a dancer who can't use my body in the same way I'm accustomed to, it challenged me in all of the ways that I could imagine being challenged. My mother actually passed a few months after my brain injury. And so then I was living with my grieving father, and my parents started dating at age 12. So my father did not know how to exist without my mother. And so now I'm supporting him. He's supporting me. And actually, I don't know that this made it into the book, but we moved into the house that we said we were going to move into. And there was an active shooter incident in our house. So, you know, safety, security, all of that, that
when
whole
you were
time period.
There?
Yeah.
You were in the house? Oh my God.
I was in the house when somebody started shooting into the house. Yeah. And my children were on their way home from school. It's a lot. I mean, listen, everybody goes through things. There is no comparison of the severity of somebody's life story. But I say at the beginning that I have lived a blessed life just to demonstrate, you know, I did not necessarily have to use the tools that I have in the way that I had to use them, because it was everything all at once, right? So that was a dramatic adjustment for me, having not needed to rely on the tools in the way that I had to during that time.
So you knew the tools, you'd been doing yoga, teaching yoga, researching yoga. It sounds like prior to all of this, you were using them for resilience and feeling better. And now
growing,
it's like,
expanding, enjoying, sharing. Yeah, exactly. I didn't need them the way that I needed them during this time.
Almost for mental, emotional, spiritual survival.
Yeah, 100%.
My name is Amy Wheeler. I'm the host of the Yoga Therapy Hour, but also the creator of a mobile app that's based on the gunas of yoga and Ayurveda. It's the first of a kind, and we'd love for you to try it for free. The app is called The Optimal State, and it tracks the state of your gunas, and then it gives you therapeutic interventions. Now we're starting to add Dharma Talks as well as Yoga Nidra. And we think these are wonderful ways that you can do some self-care and take care of yourself on a regular basis. So come join us, the Optimal State app. We'd love to see you over there too. I remember this picture that I had made an infographic, and it showed a plant, and it showed like above the soil, you're flourishing, you're growing, and you can use the yoga tools for that. And then there's the roots of the plant down beneath the surface, which is more like, I need to survive. So I'm just imagining that in my mind as you speak about this. So then what? Tell us. Like, I'm just imagining, you know, I've heard several people talk about their TBIs. That just in and of itself makes us not able to function. So I can't imagine navigating this when your brain doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. So I knew something of TBIs. In fact, my young son is a football player, and my decision to allow him to play tackle football starting at 9 years old, which, you know, every Jewish mother I ever met thought I was absolutely crazy for being willing to do that. I did as much investigating of traumatic brain injury as I could. Being a researcher, that's quite a bit, right? I could investigate it pretty thoroughly. And so I had a textbook understanding of TBI. The lived experience obviously is completely different. But I did know that it affects all aspects of your personhood in the way, you know, I often talk about arthritis as a whole person condition. People think like, oh, well, you know, you're knees hurt. Like, it's so much more than that. It affects every aspect of your life when you're living with arthritis and chronic pain conditions. And that is certainly been my experience with a TBI, because there are the physical effects. And for me, because I was hit by a truck, and so my body was affected by that. But your body is also affected by your brain, because your brain makes your body move, right? And so even aside from the car accident aspect of it, my brain working differently meant my access to the use of my body had changed. My brain working differently meant that my cognition, being able to think in the way that I was accustomed to thinking, and especially I had so much identity wrapped up in my thinkingness, it was challenging on an identity level to not be able to think in the same way. And then also the emotion. So there's the emotion. It's so complex and interwoven. Already I was experiencing all of the feelings, right? From what's happening with my mom, my family being apart. But now I'm feeling feelings about not being able to use my body the same way, not being able to use my brain the same way. And there are the direct emotional effects of changes in the brain, because it's regions of the brain that are responsible for our emotional processing, right? So my feeling states were affected by my brain function, and who I know myself to be in the world when all of that is malfunctioning or differently functioning than what I'm accustomed to. I think that I keep saying this about my identity, Amy, because I feel like of all of the things that I had to grapple with, the headaches, you know, not being able to read a paragraph because I couldn't remember what line I was on, and not being able to balance because my vestibular system was, you know, haywire. Like of all of that, it was the challenge of the thing itself, but there was the deeper challenge of who am I without this? Who am I when I can't stand on one foot and I can't read a paragraph, right? Like that more subtle impact was really profound for me.
Subtle, but deep and powerful, right? Yeah. And there's no right answer here, but was there any part of you, because everything had collapsed, your identity, your functioning mentally, physically, your family, your mom, like it all collapsed like a house. I don't want to say a house of cards, because I don't think your life was a house of cards, but I'm just picturing this like poof.
Yeah.
Is there any part of you that did become the observer? Like, whoa, I am not in control here. Was it just not available to you at that point? Because sometimes when I go through my hardest times, like the observer pops up, I'm like, get out of here. And they're like, no, we're going to observe this. And I know that part of me is watching all of this. Did you have any of that?
I was a participant observer of the entire thing from the very beginning. And I think this is, I have the yoga practices that allow me to witness my own experience. I also have my science background that is one of observation. Those are skills that didn't leave me. My ability to witness my own experience while still being profoundly impacted by it. And also, I think the scientist in me was trying to figure it out all along. And the yogi in me was trying to grow through it all along. And so from the moment it happened, I was both profoundly affected by it and willfully working through it. I mean, still today, Amy, I am different now. In choreography and in many art forms, we have this paradigm of A, B, A prime, right? So you go through a thing, which is the B, and then the A prime is that you don't ever return to A. You never go back to how you were before. You're a different version of you after it. I will forever be the A prime version of me, the version of me with the footnote of this experience. And there are ways that I'm still managing it and learning from it, even all of these years out.
And did you feel like you had no control? Or was the scientist still there kind of saying, well, the prognosis on this is 3 years from now, you'll have this function back? Or was it a total collapse, like, I am not in charge here?
I don't think it was either one. I never fully relinquished control, but I never fully had control either. So I think that I felt like I had some agency all along. There were always things that I could do, but there were also always things I could not control. It's the practice and all is coming. Like I had to let go of whether this was going to work or how it was going to work and kind of experiment with my own self and just give up the results of that to the universe, which honestly, that's what we do in science too. Like, I'm going to set up the conditions and run the experiment. And the best science has as little bias as possible, right? Non-attachment to the outcome. I'm going to run the experiment and then I'm going to be curious about what happens with that and try to understand how and why it happened. There also, honestly, was like so woefully little published in this space that there was a limit to what I could glean from the science about evidence-informed action. For example, at the beginning, I did not have the capacity to practice in the ways that I was accustomed to practicing. My like standard hatha practice, right? Like I could not do that. And so I was trying from the beginning to figure out what can I do? And especially being in integrative health all of these years, how can I work with my medical team and my, allied health professionals and enhance the effects of the wonderful care that I'm receiving? I couldn't figure out whether it was okay to meditate because I could make the argument either way, with what we know about what to do with a TBI brain, is it okay to meditate or not? And I brought this to my family doctor who was an integrative health provider, and he couldn't answer it either because there wasn't anything published on it. And even if I am capable of meditating, which there were certain approaches to meditation that were not available to me, which approach is best for my brain? Are there ways that a meditation practice could actually slow my recovery? And what was going to be also like the emotional impact? Like, if I am sitting in meditation and trying to repeat a mantra and I can't remember the mantra or I can't say the mantra for all kinds of reasons, that sort of processing becomes challenging. What are the emotional effects of the meditation practice reminding me of the things that I am struggling with? And so I sort of felt like I was experimenting in the dark in some of the ways that I was trying to utilize. When we talk about the toolbox that I had, a bunch of tools were taken out the moment I got hit by the truck, right? The just things I could not do. And then the ones that were left, I wasn't sure, can I, should I, how? And so I didn't feel like I was necessarily driving. I felt like I was reaching around in the dark.
Yeah, I'm picturing like the witness or the observer is driving the car. You're in the passenger seat, like not really knowing where we're going. What state are we going to arrive in? These are beautiful trees. Should I take a nap? Should I pay attention? Open, closed meditation, So, wow, it sounds very intense. So, what did you end up doing? I'm just curious.
Yeah, so my healthcare team was phenomenal. Now have spoken to lots of people with a TBI experience, and not everybody has what I had. Because it was a car accident, my auto insurance covered it. And because the accident happened in New York, which is a no-fault state, there was no having to prove anything. It was like, all right, this happened to you. This is
Okay.
what you get, right? And that allowed an entire year of care covered by my auto insurance, which included my family doctor, but also physical therapy with somebody who specialized in vision and vestibular physical therapy, both of which were challenges I was having. I had a cognitive rehab specialist that helped me learn how to work with my changed cognition. I had psychotherapy for all of the, which I needed anyway because of what I was going through with my family. But now my psychotherapist could help me process what was happening for me emotionally, I also had neuropsychology, which could help me understand what had happened to the specific domains of my cognitive function in order to be able to address those. As fragmented as my family life had become, I still had a support system that was incredibly loving and nourishing. And I was working at MUIH, and I had a supervisor at MUIH who was absolutely amazing, still is a wonderful human.
Can we just say her name?
Yeah, it's actually James Snow.
Oh, James. Oh,
yeah. Wow. Yeah. So I reported to James, and he was amazing through the whole thing. I continued to work in the ways that I could work to the extent that I could work. And that was actually really important for me for meaning making and also for playing with my recovery. You know, when I couldn't read a paragraph, how do you do science when you can't read a paragraph? And so navigating that, I think, was really important for me too. But having the space to be able to do it to the extent that I could without, if I had been in an R1 institution, yeah, on a grant funded project that had to be done at a certain time with certain outcomes, or I was going to lose my funding and lose my job, like that would be a very different world than what I was navigating. So I felt like I had so much support available to me that I could play with how I was using the tools that I had.
I don't know anyone else who, when they had a TBI, had all of those systems of support and nourishment around them professionally, personally, you know, healthcare advocates. I mean, it's really incredible. And I'm sure that you contributed to finding those people.
Yeah.
And having the kind of life where, you know, your family was there and supportive. You chose a great partner, wonderful parents had raised you. And then, you know, the choice to work at MUIH, which is a very different university than most universities. I'm sure you've given yourself credit for creating that sphere of nourishment prior to the accident.
I also knew enough about healthcare systems to be able to do that. Yeah, definitely. It didn't all just fall into place. I made all that happen, right? It was really hard to do without my regular brain function. I remember being on the phone with Geico, like sobbing on the phone, trying to explain and explaining to them, I'm only crying because a TBI makes you emotional and this is really hard. And I don't know where the paperwork is and I can't find this thing. And I'm not sure, right? Like navigating all, I had great coverage and it was really hard to do, you know, all of the documents and where they had to be uploaded and how, and making the appointments and getting myself to the appointments. But like all of that was a lot of work. And if I didn't know what I knew and have access to what I had access to beforehand, as you were saying, I wouldn't have been able to put all of that together in the way that I did. So they say to prepare for the worst when you're at your best, like having all of that available. And this actually happened also with my mother's passing. So my mother died a few months in. She and I actually had similar symptoms because the cancer hit her brain. And so she was having similar effects, vision, vestibular, attention, emotional regulation, cognitive function that I was. But we both knew I was going to get better and she was going to get worse. We were going to the same care providers. It was really interesting to navigate. And in cognitive rehab, they helped me plan for my mother's death. Actually, on paper, I wrote myself lists because I couldn't keep track of anything in my mind. That was one of the ways. And every brain injury is different because it depends on what regions of your brain are injured, right? My greatest impairment was working memory, the ability to hold things in my brain and manipulate them. Like I couldn't do, you know, a simple long division problem because I wouldn't know what number I had put at the top when it came time to put the next one next to it, right? So I couldn't hold anything in my brain or manipulate it. So I had to do a lot on paper and in systems that I would rely on my brain for. And that included, what am I going to do the day that my mother dies? What am I going to do the day after my mother dies, right? So what can I do before my mother dies? Which is, you know, a lot of people think that that's somber to, or even, you know, may have superstition about that. But the person that had to show up on the day my mother died was so, oh, it's going to make me cry. So incredibly grateful for the someone who made me the list. The version of me that wrote that list, because I was already so emotional and I already couldn't think straight and I also couldn't do things easily. And so having a plan that I could just go through and make all the stuff happen. I had written her eulogy while she was upstairs in the bedroom, which felt really strange to do. And I am so grateful that I did that. When I first started cognitive rehab, I was really resistant. And this was ego attachment, which was, I don't want strategies to work with a limited brain. I want to fix my brain. I want to recover. I want to get better. And you're teaching me things to deal with it. I don't want to deal with it. I want to heal it, right? And especially because I was so emotional as is from life and from the TBI, it was so hard for me to accept the usefulness of these tools. And also, it was never an either or. It was never like, we're giving you these strategies and that means you're going to have to live like this for the rest of your life. I did need the strategies and I could work on healing from the brain injury at the same time. Even as I was resisting, I was a witness to my own resistance, right? Like I could see what I was doing, but I also had compassion for myself in my inner struggle with it, if that makes sense.
Your observer was like, wow, she is struggling, rightfully so. Like not to, I'm not putting this back on you, but I'm just viscerally empathetic person, but I'm just listening to this story going, holy crud, how are we here now in 2025? Like, I don't even understand how you got, what year was this?
2018.
Okay, so it's been
some time. Yeah.
Whew. And how your family survived. I mean, these are the kinds of things that break apart marriages and—
Oh, 100%, yes.
Like, I mean, I'm just sitting here in awe.
Yeah. It all got easier. I mean, a whole bunch of things happened. Some of it healed just because in time, traumatic brain injuries do heal to an extent, right? The acute injury did heal to an extent. Some of it got better because of my tapas. I worked at it.
You know what? The word just came to me. I'm sorry. I hope nobody's offended by this swearing, but I thought, damn, she's a tough little mofo.
I am also very pitta. I'm very driven. So I was never going to let myself fall apart. I was always going to move forward. And also it got easier because emotional wounds also heal to an extent with time, right? Like my loss of my mother got easier to deal with over time. I had to grieve the things about me that I had lost at the same time as grieving the loss of my mother. I do understand so much more about grief. I think this story actually is mostly about grief because, like, the obvious grief is my mother died, and I grieve the loss of my mother, who was a central figure in my life. You grieve everything that you lost in that relationship, but you also grieve all of the future things that you expected. That's a cliche, right? We're like expecting things to go on in a certain way. We're attached to a certain way that we think that things are going to happen. So you're also grieving all of the stuff that you were never promised but expected, or I should say, I am also grieving all of that for not only my own relationship with my mother, but my relationship between my children and my mother, what my mother won't get with them and what they won't get with my mother. Amidst all of that, I am also grieving the things about myself that I have lost that will never be the same in the same way. So I am grieving the things about my own function that will never be the same. And in the same way, grieving the future ways that that function would show up in the world that are going to be different.
The A1 version has a different trajectory than the
A1. Right, exactly. And what I like to think, and part of why I wrote this book, was because I think we are all grieving all kinds of things that we don't necessarily acknowledge as grief, because they're not necessarily the loss of a human being. There are lots of kinds of loss that we all experience, you know, big L, little L losses, and giving space to the very real emotional experience of the other kinds of loss, I think allows us to be with those feelings and grow through them. I like to think that a prime version of me has gained, in terms of my own function, I believe that I have made up for the loss of function with who I have been able to grow into as a human. I would never say that that is worth the loss of my mother, because it is not. And I certainly would not ask to be hit by a truck so that I could grow into the person that I am today. But I do recognize on the profit and loss statement that I have also gained, I've gained a tremendous amount because of the work that I was willing and able to do with what I had been given.
Right. I love that you clarified that. So many times I hear people say something to the effect of, well, this had to happen so I could do XYZ and become the person I am. And that just makes me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I really like how you phrased it, that yes, this happened. And yes, I grew. And yes, I transformed. Full stop, you know?
So my father is a psychologist, which has been helpful to me in a lot of ways. But when I was small, he gave me an intelligence test that I never should have been given because of my age. And they're wildly inaccurate at young ages, because so many kids won't even do it, that if you're willing to do it, you already beat the curve. Mm-hmm. But it changed the way that my parents raised me. And I don't think that they put it on me, but I put it on myself that I was going to do something with what I got, you know, because I like won the genetics lottery or however it worked out. I had advantages.
Yeah.
I was blessed with like an incredibly loving and supportive home life, which lots of people do not get. And I was blessed with like a brain that happens to work pretty well, which not everybody gets to that degree. And a family that so was supportive of giving me what I needed to be able to use my brain. So prior to the accident, I have always felt like, maybe even to a fault, like it's my responsibility to do something with what I got. I have worked with that, seeing that as an opportunity and not a burden, so that I don't should on myself. But I think because that's so ingrained in me, in the person that I have become through the story that I've lived, when the shit hit the fan and all of this happened to me, I was going to use it. I was going to do whatever I could do with what I was given. It's not just like, oh, well, my life fell apart, so I'm going to write a book about it and get something out of this. It's like, I need to figure out how to make the most out of this experience that I have been given. And all of its trauma and its hardship and its grief and loss and its like grasping and striving and reflecting and falling apart and pulling myself back up, like all of that, I want to make sense out of this for myself. And that's really, the book was me trying to figure it out for myself, trying to write my story of this experience for myself, and also to like make something useful out of it for other people, because I do feel like we all go through this, not necessarily in the same package, in the same way. And I think seeing your own experience in somebody else's story,
yeah,
allows you to reflect on and grow from your own experience as a mirror in the way that it's harder to do when you're just processing it on your own. My life before the accident set me up to do what I did with it and therefore be where I am with it now.
Yeah. I'm just taking a breath because, you know, that figuring out the meaning of what happened to you in a very organic way for yourself first. I think that's where the most beautiful things emerge to then share. Like, I'm glad you didn't skip over that step and be like, well, I'm going to work my way through this TBI and my mother's death so I can share with other people and help them, like, which is also nice. But to really let it deeply work its way through you and then share it, that's what we want to read about.
Well, it took me a really long time, first of all, because it's really hard to write a book if your brain doesn't work the way that. So I had to heal enough, both from my mother's passing, that I could write a sentence without like soiling the page with my tears. And also I had to have the function to be able to turn thoughts into words.
Right.
That took some time. I also needed enough distance from it that I could be more witness, less participant. And COVID happened while I was writing this book. And so now I'm homeschooling my children. I'm like, you know, a couple miles away from my debt, you know, don't want to get him sick, want to make sure, like all of that, trying to work from home when now all of a sudden everybody's trying to figure out working from home. So all of that, and still wanting to spend time with my story for my own benefit and because I really did want to make something of it. The way that I did it, instead of like a chronological telling, is once the basic facts are on paper, each chapter is an essay about a certain aspect of the experience. So, you know, there's a chapter on memory, there's a chapter on balance. And so as I was writing each of those chapters, it was a way for me to reflect on that particular part of the experience separate from all of the rest that was going on, because everything affected everything else. So
right.
Being able to pull out just this little piece of it, what happened about this part of it? And what's the meaning in that? I think was part of how I was able to work my way through my own experience rather than thinking about this whole giant thing that happened.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It's a brilliant way to write a book, regardless of your capacity to, even if you could have written about the giant web all at once. I think even for the reader, having that compartmentalization might even be less overwhelming, but also more focused to really just dig one well deeply into, okay, what's balance about? And so this might be a rude question, and I apologize, but because this is such a hard story, is there any joy in any of these chapters? Is there any like inspiration?
Yeah, because I think I have a beautiful life, Amy. And so all of the tragedy of it occurs in the context of a beautiful life. And so if I'm writing, for example, about my mother's Shiva, which is, you know, the mourning period after somebody passes in the Jewish tradition, it's me experiencing it or all of the challenge of it. But it's also like, what a beautiful thing. What a beautiful thing to have the opportunity to be supported, to have everyone you love, everyone who loved this person, show up and hold you. And so I think that there are a lot of aspects of the book that are both tragic and beautiful. You know, when I write about being in a different state from my husband, reasons why he couldn't drive to me, I had to drive to him. And I had not only a TBI, but I had PTSD from being hit by a truck. And so I had to drive to my husband, trying not to white knuckle the steering wheel, trying to make sure that I was breathing, like managing the triggers at every turn. And so the trauma of that is in the context of like, I'm fighting for my love. That also is going to be funny. I am like pushing through my own discomfort to be with the person I love, who is waiting on the other side for me with open arms. And so there is the beautiful marriage that is going through the challenge of this massive disruption. And I think that that is woven throughout the whole book, is that like none of it is just bad. It's all tragic and beautiful all at once.
And that is life. That's the reality. Yours was very intensified during this time. But I think that's such a good reminder to all of us that it's never yin, it's never yang. You know, if you really look at that symbol of there's the hard stuff with the little white dot in the middle, and there's the beautiful stuff with a little black dot in the middle, and it's flowing through both always. Yeah. So, Stephanie, what is the name of your memoir?
It's called Driving Home. We were just talking about the driving part of it. So actually, I'm at my dad's house visiting right now. And so I thought, oh, I might want to look at that. So I grabbed his copy, which is so cool, Amy, because it's Driving Home, Cancer, Concussion, Mom, and Me. And so I grabbed my father's copy. So it's like sitting behind his desk in his office. So when he's on a Zoom call, it's like so sweet. But also he's got all these post-it notes on different pages that he's stuck there, like at the spot where there's a passage. Like he didn't want to write in the book, but he wanted to note things. And so I'm so glad that I grabbed it off of his shelf. My daughter actually also, she had to read a memoir for AP English. And she said, for my AP English class, I want to read your book. And so she wrote in it. My daughter, who was very much a part of that story, I get to see her reflection on the way that I experienced the story that she was a part of. So Driving Home, Cancer, Concussion, Mom, and Me.
Wow. And when is this book coming out?
It's out. It's out.
It is.
Actually, yeah. So it's available now in hardback, paperback, and ebook. The audiobook is on the way. So for those of you who are audiobook listeners, I actually hope that by the time this airs, the audiobook should be available. And I read the audiobook. So you do hear me getting choked up as I read certain passages, which I think is just, it's authentic. So if you want that experience, you might want to listen to the ebook. I mean, the audiobook.
It's hard to transition back to your clothing and identity as professional after that. I have utmost respect for you being able to hold on to all of these parts of yourself and keep them together in an integrated way. But if we were to transition as we close out the interview back to some of the things you're doing professionally, I want to bring up your website, which is www.arthritis.yoga. So instead of a .com, it's a .yoga, arthritis.yoga. And what do you have coming up, Stephanie, in terms of offerings and things if people wanted to come study with you? What's going on professionally for you?
Yeah, thank you for asking, Amy. So we have a few different things going on. I think your audience is mostly yoga professionals. And so I can speak to that specifically, which is continuing education programs for both yoga teachers and yoga therapists. And we actually have a bunch of them. So a lot of what we offer is available self-paced online. But there are also live things that are happening all the time. We are mostly online. I do travel and do things in person sometimes, but our sort of main continuing education program is the Yoga for Arthritis training program. And that has three steps. You don't have to do them all, but there are three steps to the process to really specializing in working with arthritis and chronic pain. The first part of it, honestly, I think is what every 200-hour yoga teacher should have learned and probably didn't, just because, I mean, I think 200 hours is too little to learn so much of what we need as yoga professionals in the world. And so that actually grew right out of the research that I was doing way back when I started this organization, and it has only grown to be informed by additional research that we've done. So it's very evidence-based. It's also multi-kosha. So it's not about how to modify asana for joint pain. I mean, that's in it, and that's why people think they should take it. But it's so much more than that, because it's really about the whole person who is living with these conditions and all of the ways that life is changed and all of the ways to use the vast toolbox of yoga to help manage all of those aspects of life with arthritis and chronic pain. So the way we've been talking about the effects of a traumatic brain injury being so complex and multi-layered, that's how we think about arthritis and chronic pain. And for those who want to do that part of it, we're actually doing an online cohort of it. If this airs in time, I think it starts July 15th. We can give you the specifics. And then you'll actually move through the course with a group of people and with support from me live on Zoom. If not, it's self-paced. It's available all the time. And I am always in there interacting with you every step of the way. So you're getting feedback throughout. And if you're a person who wants to do things in person, in real life, we're going to be offering it at Yogaville summer of 2026. So if you want to wait a whole year to be able to do it at an ashram, then that's available as well. But we have a bunch of other programs too, meditation practices and how to work with those with this population, yoga philosophy and how it applies to life with chronic pain. So there's an Ayurveda course, there's a Bhagavad Gita course. And so there's a lot that's available in there for those who are looking for continuing education opportunities and mentoring with me. So if you have students or clients who are living with any form of arthritis or chronic pain, and you have questions or want to work through specific scenarios or development of a care plan, feedback, et cetera, you can work with me as a mentor, and I'm happy to support you one-on-one. Amy, you're good at like navigating the site and finding all the stuff as I riff about what we offer. Thank you for doing that.
Looking around, I'm like, oh, it's probably there. Oh, Stephanie, well, thank you for being with us today. I know I've taken longer than we had planned to be together, but I just really appreciate you going to the depths of what can only be described as, I don't want to say this word, but like hell. Like you really went to the depths and you have emerged as a prime version that's still here doing great work, loving your family, taking care of your family, nourishing your students. It's really beautiful to see the emergence or maybe the phoenix that has risen from those challenging times. So thank you for
Amy, thank you. Thank you for holding this space for me to share. And thank you for holding this space for all of what is happening in this podcast. I think it's really beautiful. And I am so grateful that you have stepped into your current role at MUIH. I just know that you're going to do beautiful and amazing things in that position. And so I am like, so glad to see you at the helm of that program that I helped to birth. And so I feel very, whether I should or not, I feel some attachment to that program.
You and Marlisa and Diane Finlayson and so many people birthed this baby that I get to carry with the other faculty and with our other chairs and our provost and our president. And as you know, we're going to be merging with Notre Dame of Maryland University as a graduate program over there in the next year. So it is, I'm carrying the baby for a little while and I'll do the best I can to take care of her. And I appreciate that you birthed her. So
thank you. I think she might be a teenager now, Amy.
Oh, I think she is. She's a little wild.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie, for being here and keeping it so real. The story that we just heard and felt and sensed inside of us, I think all of us will have to go through something similar in this life. And it's always a surprise when it happens. It's a surprise when we hear that a loved one doesn't have much time left. It's a surprise when we get into a big accident or we get an unexpected illness and we realize that all we have is this moment. And so maybe, you know, the call to action after listening to Stephanie's story is to really take some time to think about, if I were to have a surprise, is there anything that I want to do to prepare for this? Anything that I want to do to be resourced enough to handle whatever might come in life? Are there any ways I can nourish myself and make decisions that will put me in a position where whatever happens, I will have more support, more nourishment, and less living like on a thread, that if that one thread breaks, we're in big trouble? And I know that a lot of that comes from privilege, to have a loving family, to have an education, to have any kind of financial sustenance in case that thread breaks. So I don't want to appear that like we can just manifest this nourishment and prepare when we ourselves are suffering. I think that is a big part of what is happening. And in every moment of life, we get to make decisions about who we spend our time with, how we spend our time, what we do first thing in the morning, the choices we make to take a job or not take a job. And just knowing that every one of those little Y's in the road has a right fork and a left fork, and it matters. Many, many, many tiny decisions lead to a very, very different trajectory of life. So with that, I will see you next week. Thank you for listening, and I hope that we'll be in touch soon. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We are really, really blessed to have you all as listeners. We can feel the energy coming back, the gratitude, and we want you to know how much we appreciate you out there in the audience. Every little bit of goodness that we share with you from our guests goes into your ears, down into your heart. I am hopeful that it radiates out into the world. That is the goal. So thank you for being our dependable and reliable listeners. You have no idea how much we appreciate seeing those downloads every single week. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.